culture and technology entail widely combined in their onslaught on nature, whereas they become a means of reconnecting with nature in cage. If Gary Snyder's serenity in describing things to do around a mountain lookout is difficult to imagine in German poetry, at least any poetry that understands itself as environmentally engaged, Cage's fusion of advanced technology and nature is equally hard to conceive in a poetry that sees modern technology as fiercely opposed to nature and maybe to human life itself. Now, these differences, and this is kind of what I've attempted to show here, don't derive primarily from any fundamental divergence in the way the ecological crisis is experienced in Germany and the U.S., but rather from the kind of poetic discourses that are culturally available in the late 60s and early 70s to address this crisis by aesthetic and literary means. So the comparatist perspective points to some of the ways in which debates over the role and configurations of the real environmental literature need to shift once they're taken beyond individual national contexts or the framework of particular indigenous traditions. What's at stake in different literary portrayals of environmental issues is not only varying experiences of crisis or divergent philosophical perspectives on the interaction of humans with nature, but also, and often I would argue more centrally, the shaping influence of genres and metaphors that are contextually available to translate eco-crisis into aesthetic form, as well as, of course, those that are not accessible for particular, if also contingent, historical reasons. American eco-criticism has often assumed that eco-poetry arises from writers' connections to the places they inhabit and has tended to assess poetry in terms of how it reflects this experience of place and the exposure to ecological crisis. Or in a somewhat different vein, it has approached environmental literature in general and environmental poetry in particular as an aesthetic staging ground for fundamentally philosophical reflections on the essence of human encounters with nature. My point here isn't to deny that these elements play a role in environmental writing. Obviously, they do. Rather, it is to emphasize that portrayals of the human encounter with nature are crucially shaped by contingencies of cultural, aesthetic, and literary history. In the U.S., for example, the very emphasis on embeddedness in place can itself be understood as a product of an at least bicentennial cultural tradition that casts rootedness as the antidote to the nation's characteristic restlessness and mobility, and that's an argument that I've made at more length in the book that Liz has mentioned. By the same token, the bitterness, militancy, and pessimism of German eco-poetry certainly has something to do with the cultural and political situation of the two Germanies in the 1970s and with the active involvement of many of the poets in the anti-nuclear and green movements. But it is also, and just as importantly, conditioned by a literary history that made the placid contemplation of nature and its unqualified celebration unavailable as poetic modes in the 1970s. In other words, what's recorded in eco-poetry is not just a however authentic experience of nature and not just political and social struggle, but also the literary and cultural history of encounters with nature. The task of comparative eco-criticism in this context is to show not only how environmental crisis presents itself through the lens of different cultural traditions, but how even the most fundamental environmentalist concepts, things such as nature, organism, environment, or for that matter, crisis, are conceived and experienced through the geological pressures of past contingencies that have sedimented in particular aesthetic forms and genres, or their absence. Thank you.
Thank you for such a broad-ranging and rich talk. We have some time for a discussion, but briefly I wanted to mention that we're holding a workshop tomorrow discussing species extinction at lunch. So if you have an RSVP to Amanda, either talk with Amanda or me after our discussion period, if you want to continue this discussion on to tomorrow. So do we have questions?
First, thanks. It's a very engaging, interesting talk. I have two questions, I think, both of which arise from the distinction on the chart you provide here, distinguishing materialist and non-materialist approaches to environmentalism.
Yeah.
One is, does this seem to you to correspond to a tension within eco-criticism between a kind of activist presentist project and a much more kind of aesthetic or traditionally scholarly form of approach? The second is more historically specific to the 1960s, 70s period you're working with, where it seems to me possible that environmentalism emerged partly because there was exactly a split like this, was becoming increasingly problematic for the new left, whereby you had a new left political movement recognizing its increasingly divergent interests from a kind of countercultural hippie lifestyle movement, and that it seemed possible through environmentalism to try to reunite those two forces toward becoming a bit more of a successful movement.
Yeah, I think that latter is, I mean, that's a very provocative formulation, I think, of the political and intellectual history, and I think an interesting way of looking at the emergence of environmentalism. I think you're right about the split, but I would probably, within environmentalism, I would probably cast it a little bit differently, though, because I think in the U.S., what's fascinating is that I don't think that the sort of more aesthetic, non-utilitarian engagement with nature was not necessarily non-political. I mean, if you think of something like Friends of the Earth, I mean, the real biocentrics who really want nature without humans and with as little human interference as possible, but they're very militant, you know, or the sea shepherds and stuff like that. I mean, these environmentalist organizations that have precisely the kind of attitude toward nature that Ramachandra Guha attacks. And he attacked it in an essay that's also included in the Varieties of Environmentalism, but which came out earlier, where he sort of lambasts American environmentalism for his investment in wilderness, which he says in the third world is really deadly in a literal sense, because it then leads to the expulsion of indigenous populations or simply poor populations that have actually used natural areas sustainably for the sake of establishing national parks and stuff like that in India and in Africa. So he's very much opposed to an ideal of nature that would exclude certain kinds of human uses. So I would probably draw the dividing line a little bit differently. I mean, I think there definitely is that deep divide between the sort of more the social ecology of Amurray Bookchin and his engagement with a political left and the whole sort of what we now call sort of anthropocentric environmentalism and the biocentrics. Which really, I mean, I think it's an open question whether they are leftist in any, at least European sense. I mean, I think it's actually a somewhat different tradition. I mean, in some ways they are, and then in others they aren't left in their political ideology. But I'm not sure that it lines up with being politically engaged or not. I think they both are, but in different ways.
If I can just jump in and add to that, because I know, as you know very well, Ramachandra Guha also makes an argument of another kind of split, which is to say that at the rise of the 1960s civil rights movement, you have a split where you have civil rights movement, women's rights, and then environmentalism, right? And so there's also another split that he points out, and obviously these are kind of heuristic terms, but in terms of how people are aligned, but that also his critique is that there was a shift in terms of people who weren't engaging in particular forms of civil rights that actually preferred to move into the environment, seeing the environment as a way of kind of subsuming all other kind of human difference, which I think is also another important shift to happen.
Yeah, and that's kind of coming back to haunt us, I mean, in interesting ways, because if you look at the recent debates around the Schellenberger and Nordhaus piece, the What is Environmentalism, and then the Adam Warbach piece, Environmentalism is Dead, I mean, he's a very young director of the Sierra Club, where I think what comes to the fore, I mean, what Schellenberger and Nordhaus deplore is that environmentalists have become just another special interest group, right? And they say, well, why haven't environmentalists engaged more with other movements? So why, for example, do they always think of the car companies as their enemy when they could really say, okay, so the car companies have real problems financing retirement plans for their employees, which is something that environmentalists should at least indirectly be interested in, since it's sort of the welfare of the working class. And why don't they sort of make a pact and say, okay, we'll support you on that if you in turn will invest more money into developing green cars, and hybrid cars, and so forth. And so their argument is, and this has been made by other, I mean, I think they build on the work done by other sort of more cultural historians, that, I mean, precisely that moment in the 60s when this category of environment and environmentalism emerges in its modern configuration actually brings together wildly different issues, right? Some of which have to do with land management, some of which have to do with labor, some of which have to do with public health. And they're really kind of not inherently related or not conceived as such before. And so the great achievement of the environmentalist movement was to make them, in the way that